From beach towels to tea towels, and from mugs to water bottles, the TNT Shop has it all. Browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Welcome to the Dirk Pohlman Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome to the Dirk Pohlman Show from Berlin, Germany. My guest today is Mohamed Barakat, sorry, Arabic is a little bit foreign to my tongue. And we will talk about the current situation in Gaza and in Palestine. Mohamed Barakat is from the West Bank, so not really from Gaza. But maybe you introduce yourself to the audience, who you are and why we're doing this interview.
Well, hi for all. My name is Mohamed Barakat. I'm a Palestinian. I am the second generation of the refugees. So my family were the first generation. My family used to live in a village close to Jerusalem. It was on the main road between Jerusalem and Jaffa. And through because of the war of 1948, and mainly because of the massacre which happened in 1948 on the 9th of April against a small town called Deir Yassin, which caused a lot of killing. And that where the rumors started to spread in all over the villages around that village. So the people on the 10th of April, 1948, my family were part of it. They fled out. They went to have a shelter, a refuge in another village, waiting if things will calm down to go back to their village, which never happened. So they stayed over there in that village for 2 weeks. Then they moved to the old city of Jerusalem and they settled over there. And in fact, they settled in a mosque inside the old city in the Christian quarter. It's called Saladin Mosque. And they stayed over there more than 3 months till they started their life. You know, they didn't take anything on them when they just fled out. Because it used to happen before that time, something that, you know, clashes used to be, and it will remain for a couple of days and it will just calm down, but not that time. So they started to rent a house in Jerusalem, and that's they started to, you know, to start their life again out of their village, out of their land. And I was born later in the old city of Jerusalem. I was an eyewitness over the war of 1967. We were living in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, which is a famous now neighborhood. So I remember how things used to be before the war of 67 and up till today. So I was living all the time through my life through the occupation. So I got married in 1975. I have five children, three daughters and two sons. So those are the third generation of the refugees. Beside them, I have 12 grandchildren, which those are the fourth generation. So my story is similar to millions of those Palestinians since 1948 up till today. I started to work in the hotel tourism sector in 1977. I was working in one of the famous hotels on East Jerusalem. It's called the National Palace Hotel. And I resigned at the end of 1995, 1996. I started to have my own businesses, and I started to do these types of work, which we call it the alternative tours in the occupied territories and in Israel. Yeah, so I'm still working in these types of work with the Green Olive Tours and other tourist agencies.
Yes, that would be a recommendation if somebody goes there to find let's say the other side of the history. If they go to the Holy Land, a lot of people from Germany visit the Holy Land, and to know something about the history of Palestine, the company you are working for is one of the good sources that you can have to get a more complete spectrum of what's going on there. You were recommended to me by Nirit Sommerfeld, my German-Israeli Jewish friend who thinks very highly of you. So she said, if you want to talk to a reasonable, very good, very knowledgeable Palestinian, try to get in contact with Mohamed Barakat, which I did now. And when we chatted on the phone before this interview, you said it's essential. We have to talk about the history of the past. So the floor is yours for that. You have about 15-20 minutes, and please explain why you think it is important to go back in history to understand what's going on now.
Well, It's a long history our country had been in. And I will go briefly in the first part of it, which is takes us back more than 6,000 years, which is the time that we started to know about this country through the Canaanite tribes, which they are Arabs. They were living in this region. And in the time of the Canaanites, that's when Father Abraham came in to visit, you know, passing through the countries. He came from North Iraq, south of Turkey, through Syria, and to this land. And he settled in Hebron, the city south of Jerusalem. And this is the time that we started to know about the religion, you know, to be to know God, only God, you know, because before that they have their own gods, those tribes. And we're talking about more than 3,800 years when Father Abraham came to the country. Through the time, we have the second people who came and settled in the country. We are talking about the Philistine. The Philistine are the people who came from the islands of the Mediterranean, and they settled in the southern coast of the country. But slowly, slowly, those two people, which is the Philistines and the Canaanites, have been, you know, living in coexistence under the protection of the Egyptian army. So Egypt was the main power. We're talking about 1500 BC. Mm-hmm. So those are the two people who were in it. And then we had the third people who came to the country, and they were called the Israelites, the people who exodus from Egypt, lost in the desert in Sinai, and coming to Transjordan's mountains, where they saw what they call the promised land. Moses have died over there, and he had been buried over there in Mount Nebo. Later on, the Israelites conquered the country, and the first city which they conquered, it was Jericho, by the leadership of Joshua ben Nun. They took over the city, they burned it, they killed everyone. Only one lady survived, which used to be their spy in the city, Haviva. And they moved to the Rehab, and they moved to the north through the valley, because they have seen from the mountains that the southern part of the country, just on the other side of the Dead Sea, it's completely dry area, desert. So they moved to the north, and that's where this ended into, lasted in what we call it Shechem, the name of the city. They took over it, and they changed the name to be Shechem, which it was the first capital of the Israelite kingdom. So they lived over there. They started to have wars with the Canaanites, with the Philistines, to enlarge the size of their country. And that's, so talks about it in the Torah, in their books, in their texts, talking about the wars like Goliath and David and Samson and Delilah. All those stories is written, knows about it. Till they just start to enlarge the size of the kingdom, and they took, in the time of King David, they took Jerusalem as their capital, and they changed the name to be Jerusalem, which was called before Yabus in the time of the Canaanites, and then they changed the name to be Jerusalem, and then Jerusalem. After the death of David, Solomon took over, King Solomon, and this is the time we know that he built the first temple in Jerusalem. So during the years after the death of Solomon, that's where the war broke between the North Kingdom, which is Samaria, and the South Kingdom, which is Judah. And that's the time when the conquerors came to the country. And we're talking about almost 900 BC. So the first conquerors who came to the country, they were the Assyrians. They conquered the North Kingdom. They destroyed everything over there in 784 BC. Then we have the second people who came to the country. They were the Babylonians. Those are the ones who moved to the south, and those are the ones who have conquered Jerusalem and destroyed Jerusalem in 586 BC. Nebuchadnezzar was the leader. So this is the time when the first temple had been destroyed. This stayed in the country up till 540, when we have the third conquerors of the country. They were the Persians. And the Persians took over and lasted up till 332. We have another big power came up, which is the Hellenistics. They stayed in the country from 332 up till 70 BC, when the West Roman Empire took over. And it is the time that most of the people in that region have converted the Judaism. Then we have the Romans. In the time of the Romans, that's when Jesus had been born and the new religion had been founded, which is the Christianity. But it was forbidden to practice this religion in public. It was completely in secret. So during the years of that, the West Roman Empire, it was, we had the Judaism, the Christianity, the new religion, up till 324, when we have the East Roman Empire. And this is a time when that empire, the king, the queen herself, had converted the Christianity. So the country became Christian country. During the East Roman Empire, which was called the Byzantinians, there was the revolt of the Samaritans, which happened in 525 against the Romans, but they had been defeated. In 614, we had the second conquer of the Persians in the country. They didn't last more than 15 years. The Byzantinians were back, but they didn't last long because in 636, we have the Arab Muslims in the country. So this is how the movement of the religion have been taken over in the country. So we have the new religion, which is the Islam. And this is where we have several of those Muslim dynasties who have ruled the country. We have the Rashidun. Mecca was the capital. Then we have the Umayyad. Damascus was the capital. And in the time of the Umayyad, that's where the expansion of the Muslim state have been taking over the to the west up till Spain and to the east up to India. And then we have the third Arab Muslim dynasty, which is the Abbasid. They took Baghdad, their capital. We have several of those Muslims dynasties who have ruled, which like the Ptolemaeans, Akhshadians, but not originally Muslims. Up till the 9th, 10th century, we have a big power coming from northeast. They took over Egypt. And those are the ones who have built Cairo. And those were called the Fatimid. They are the descendants of Fatima, the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, and she was the wife of Ali. And in the time of the Fatimid, we have the split of the Muslim faith. The Shia and the Sunni started from that period. In 1099, we have the Crusaders in the country. So the Crusaders came and took over, and they lasted more than 90 years in Jerusalem till 1187, when Saladin, the Ayyubid, have liberated the country from the Crusaders, and the Muslims came back. So we have the Ayyubid era. Then we have the Mamluk. The Mamluk came also in the middle of the 13th century from Egypt, and those are the ones who have stopped the conquer of the Tatar, the Mongolians. They have defeated the Tatar in a big battle in the north. It's called Ain Galut in 1260. No more Tatar. And the last Crusaders fortress had been taken down by the Mamluk, which is San John of Acre, in 1291. So no more Crusaders in the region. The Mamluk have stayed in the country up till 1517. We have the Ottomans, the Turk. Now, during the Turk, 1799, Napoleon Bonaparte came to the country. He took over the coastal area till he reached Akko, and that's where he had been defeated. No more French in the region. So in the time of the Ottomans, up till the 19th century, it was forbidden to sell land property neither to Jews or Christians. It was only for Muslims. 1831, the Egyptian army came and took over the region. Egypt was ruled by a governor who had been appointed by the Sultan. Originally, he's an Albanian officer. His name is Muhammad Ali Pasha. He took Egypt as his own country for his own dynasty. He wants to enlarge the size of Egypt, so he sent his son, Ibrahim Pasha, to take over the Middle East. He succeeded to take over, and he started to change part of the laws, which the Ottomans were using. He started to sell land property to Christians and Jews as a way to get support against the Ottomans. But the Egyptian army had been defeated in 1840, and the Ottomans came back. The Ottomans took the power and the privilege of their new law. They started to sell land property to internationals to build their consulates and also to the missionaries to build their colonies. And this is when we started to have the colonies in the main cities in the region, like Jerusalem, in Jaffa, in Nazareth, in Haifa. And that's how it started. Now, the main thing which happened in that century, it's in 1869. We have the Suez Canal. And that changed a lot of things. The Suez Canal was a new water passage to close the distance between the British Empire, England.
May I interrupt
and its
you
colonies.
Here, Mohammed? We have to get to the advertisements and keep your mind spot on the Suez Canal, because that's really important. After the advertisements, we start again.
All right.
Why the Suez Canal is so important.
TNT Radio's Kate Shimarani.
Last night was an interesting one in London. The Metropolitan Police in Trafalgar Square. They were getting pelted with fireworks by the pro-Palestinian. From what I could see from the footage, they must have been in on the act, because they weren't doing anything. There was didn't look like they were doing any arrests. And I seem to remember being chased down Whitehall by hundreds of cops in my stilettos and green cape. But so I'm still on YouTube, 3.2 million views. And I was arrested. And then I was arrested later, and they sent the helicopter and lots of riot police in to get me. They didn't get me that day, but they got me later. And that was me, a woman in her 50s with a pair of high heels on. But no, they were part of the Guy Fawkes night last night, aka agents of the state, Metropolitan Police. Political policing, is it? And you can only come down with your batons and your riot police, the TSG, on peaceful British citizens campaigning against lockdown. Oh, do I sound bitter? I don't think so.
Kate Shimarani on TNT Radio.
People might tell you that Lyme doesn't kill people, but we are losing people. People disappear from their lives.
One of the scariest things that I had to deal with was memory loss. Not just like I don't remember what I did last week, but like I forgot all the words to my own songs. I remember going to my primary care physician, and he was like, you are 100% healthy. There's nothing wrong with you. And my response was, that's impossible. I'm dying.
I wasn't working. So I had all of these hospital bills. We had to move out of our home and move into my parents' basement.
I just wish I could have truly been present in those big moments, you know, when she took her first steps, or, you know, her first day of preschool. Lyme is such a thief, and it goes undetected because no one is looking for it.
For more information and prevention tips, go to projectlyme.org.
When government efficiency is about as good as the smell of a rest area bathroom,
quite frankly, it stinks.
You need today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And here's again Dirk Pullmatt from my own show on TNT Radio with Mohammed Barakat. And he was starting to talk about the Suez Canal when I interrupted him. And this is where we go now deeply into geopolitics that are important to this day. But maybe in the end, you can give us an idea why this history that started really 6,000 years ago, why you think it is important to understand the conflict today. But
because
please go on with the Suez Canal.
It shows you the importance of this country for the three religions. So everybody wants to be here. And it is mainly, it's completely a part of the international's main religions of the world, that everybody wants to come here for the Holy Land, you know, Christians, Jews, and Muslims. It's related for them, and they have to come to practice their prayers and so on. So that's the main of it. But also,
very good.
But also, if you look carefully on the map, you could see that the main three continents of the world, it was connected with this part. The east coast of the Mediterranean, that's where the movement of the ancient, you know, people have to pass through this corridor. This is the importance. It's the main important road or way or passage between the three continents of the world. This is the importance of it. So when we had the Suez Canal, it just, you know, that the distance that the British, mainly the, from England to the Far East colonies, which is India, Hong Kong, China, Persia, the Gulf countries also, they have to go around the world, you know, South Africa, Cape Town, and up to, so it was a long distance. So the Suez Canal was important. So since that time, the British have focused over the Suez Canal. They took over Egypt in 1882 under their protection as a way to protect the Suez Canal. Themselves, the British, and the French company, which was the ones in charge of the Suez Canal. Now, in 1897, we had the first Zionist conference, which had been held in Basel, in Switzerland. And during that conference, they formed a delegation to meet with the Sultan in Istanbul to offer him proposals from the Zionist movement as a way to pay part of the debts of the Turkish or the Ottoman Empire, and also to invest in the Ottoman Empire. But they need, instead of it, a piece of land to build the Jewish state, which was for them focusing over Palestine. So the Sultan rejected their proposal and they had been kicked out. So they turned their faces towards Britain. And that's where they, both strategies of those two, the Zionist movement and the British government have matched each other. They have the similar strategy. And this is where we started to have the conspiracy against the country here, Palestine. So imagine that you were living in this region in 1905, the beginning of the 20th century. We didn't have borders among the countries here. It was only one country, one land, which was called the Fertile Crescent or the Greater Syria. People used to move from this city to another city in the region without any border. It had been inhabited in 1905 by 600,000 people. Over 85% of the population there were Muslims, 10% were Christians, and less than 5% were Jews. And those are the Jewish community who came to the country after they had been kicked in from Spain in the 15th century. They came and settled in four towns in the country, which is Safed, Tiberias, Jerusalem, and Hebron. And during the time when the Ottomans gave the right to the missionaries to buy land property, so they came and bought land property. A lot of those Ishkenazim, Jewish families. So they were living among the Arabs in the country, and they were called Palestinian Jews. And in 1905, they were less than 5%, but the land property that those people succeeded to bought, it was less than 2.2% of the land property in Palestine. Things started to change after 1916-17, the First World War, where the British and France were against the Germans and the Ottomans, and they need the Arabs to join them. So they succeeded to convince the Sheikh Hussein bin Ali, the prince in Al-Hijaz, to join them against the Ottomans and the Germans, and they will call him to be the king of the region. So he sent a big Arab army led by his three sons, Abdullah, Faisal, and Ali, to join the British army against the Ottomans. And they succeeded to liberate the country, to defeat the Ottomans and the Germans. But there was a big conspiracy between these two countries, which is the France and France and Britain, which we call it the first conspiracy against the region, the Sykes-Picot Agreement.
Yes.
According to the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the region had been divided among those two countries. The northern part of the region, or the Fertile Crescent, had been given to the French mandate, which is Lebanon and Syria. And they should give also the northern part of Iraq, which is the Kurdish part, to France. But France didn't want to have it. So they just took only Lebanon and Syria. So Iraq, Jordan, and Palestine was under the British mandate. And the second conspiracy came with the Declaration of Balfour to give land in Palestine to have a Jewish state. Now, the Zionist leadership that time, they proposed for the British to have their own country, which was much more larger than the country that they took over it, which the border of that country was the main water resources, the Litani River in the southern part of Lebanon, the whole Golan Heights, the whole Mediterranean coast, also access to the South Sea, which is the Red Sea, and the whole Jordan Valley, even the eastern mountains on east bank of the Jordan River, they need it because it's a main part for the military strategy to have the mountains. Because east of the mountains on east side of the Jordan Valley used to be desert. They don't need it. So they need the water resources, the Jordan River, the Sea of Galilee, and also the Dead Sea, and the access to the water of the Red Sea. So all that had been proposed, but it didn't work like that. So in 1917, the British took over. In 1920, they have appointed the high commissioner in the country, Herbert Samuel, which he was a Zionist Jew. And this is the time when he gave the right to any Jewish family and all over the world to come to Palestine. So the population started to change. In the 30s, end of the 20s, 30s, they came to be over 28% of the population in Palestine. With all the revolts, with all the strikes, the demonstration that the Palestinians have against the British mandate, they didn't succeed to stop the immigration of the Jewish people from all over the world to Palestine. In the 30s, 40s, they came to be over 35% because of the Second World War, where more of those Jews came after what happened in Europe. So we started to have these types of, you know, clashes and so on between the two people in the country, the Arabs and the Jews, under the British mandate. And with the influence of the Zionist movement against even under against the Jewish population in the country to join them to have what they call it a revolution against the British mandate to liberate the country. So in 1947, the British have informed the United Nations to have a resolution or a kind of a peaceful solution among those two people. So they reached what we call it the Partition Plan of Palestine, which is a resolution, 184 resolution, to divide the country between the Arabs and the Jews. So they gave over 55% of the land to have the Jewish state, which comes to be the corridor on the seaside, on the Mediterranean, access to the water resources on the northeast, which is the Jordan River and the Sea of Galilee and Al-Hula, Al-Hula Lake, small lake, north of Sea of Galilee, and also an access down south towards the Red Sea, which is the largest part of the state that time was the desert, the Negev. And the main strategy of the Zionist movement that time was they accepted that resolution because they have nothing to lose. And it was a way that we want to bloom the desert. That was the philosophy of the Zionist movement, which they were planning for it since the beginning. So the Arab state was given about 42% of the land, which is the mountains, the West Bank, Gaza Strip. Even Jaffa, the city, was given to the Palestinian Arab state, which was about 42%. The almost 2.5 to 3% was Jerusalem and Bethlehem should be under a international, you know, rule. So this is how it happened, where the Arabs, Palestinians have rejected the partition plan because you are giving something for people which they don't have anything here. It's not your land to give it and to play with it. And it ended in the war of 1948. Where Israel, the Zionist movement, had been ready for the war. They had over 60,000 soldiers with all the equipments, with all the weapons. And they succeeded to take over 78%, even with the interventions of the Arab armies, like the Egyptian, the Jordanians, and even the Iraqi army, the Syrians. But they didn't succeed to stop.
Let me ask that. What I've heard is that the Arabs attacked Israel in 1948.
Came in, but you have to know that in that time, in that period, when we are talking about 1948, most of those Arab countries were still under the British mandate power. Mm-hmm. The Jordanians, they have the senior officer of the Jordanian army was Club Basha, which is a British. Egypt was under the King Farouk, which is part of the British colony that time. We didn't have that weapons that time, the army. They didn't have that good weapons to as what the Israelis that time or the the Israeli army was having. So they succeeded in defeating the Arab countries and causing the flood of over 700,000 Palestinians to be refugees. So this is how it started. So we reach in 1949 the ceasefire in Rhodes between Egypt and Israel and also Jordan and Israel, where in that time the internationals, also the United Nations, have a resolution in November 1948, which is called the Right of Return, 194 resolution, yes, to give the right to the Palestinians refugees to go back to their land, property, where Israel denied that and they didn't work with that resolution. They said that they left the country by themselves and they don't have the right. And in 1949, they established what they called the UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Work Agency for the Palestinians, to take care of those refugees, which those people have fled to five Arab countries, the surrounding countries, to Lebanon, to Syria, to the West Bank, Jordan, and Gaza, which was part of Egypt. So the Palestinians have been divided that time since 1948. Some of those Palestinians have stayed in that in their land property during the war of 1948. And the land that those people have been staying in, and Israeli just left them over there, it was part of the Palestinian Arab state. So Israel, they didn't want to force those people to leave because they know that if the internationals will implement the resolution of 947, so they have to come back. So they left them over there thinking that the internationals will go on the implementation of the partition plan, which is 181 resolution, okay? Mm-hmm. So after the war of 1948, up till the 50, when they discovered that the internationals are not in favor of going to do the implementation of 181, Israel, to deal with the new regime that they have it after the declaration of the Independence Day, and to prove to the world, and mainly the main power, that they are a socialist, progressive, and secular democratic state, they gave those people the Israeli citizenship.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like very shortly to interrupt here, because that's not very well known, that in the beginning, Israel was protected rather by the Soviet Union than anybody else. It got its weapons from Czechoslovakia, and it was considered to become, this was the hope of the Soviets, that Israel become part of the socialist community, so to speak.
You're right. So you're right. That's yes. Why. That's why the Soviet Union have, recognized Israel as a state, thinking that they will be part of the Soviet Union, because mostly they were from East Europe. Mm-hmm. But they have their own plans that time, the Israelis. So that's why they gave them the Israeli citizenship, those people. So those people, imagine that Israel in 1950, the population of Israel was less than 900,000 people. There were only 880,000. Among them, there were almost 160,000 Palestinians, Israelis. So this is the first Palestinian Arab category. We call them the Arab Israeli citizens. So they were 160,000. So the other Palestinians who have fled out, some of them went to the north. The ones who were in the northern part, they moved to the north, and they have, lasted in Lebanon and in Syria. Others in the center of the country, they moved to the east, and they came to the mountains, which is the West Bank, and some of them moved even more to the east towards Jordan. And the others were in the south, they moved towards Gaza and Sinai, okay? And that's how it ended. Now, the people who were stuck in Gaza, they were part of the Egypt regime. So they were under the influence of the Egyptian country. The ones who have moved to the West Bank and to Jordan, in 1950, we had, as a people in the West Bank, we didn't have any types of government. So we had a conference in Jericho, and through that conference, we urged the king of Jordan to have us in a unity. So we became citizens of Jordan in 1950. So we were carrying the Jordanian passports, different than the other Palestinians who had been stuck in Lebanon in Syria and in Gaza. Those were carrying documents to prove that they are visitors in these countries. Okay? Mm-hmm. So this is what happened. Now, to know why Suez Canal was important, in 1952, there was the new revolution in Egypt, where the army took over the power, and they exiled and they just kicked out the king of Egypt. In 1956, Nasser, the president, have nationalized the Suez Canal. And that caused the war that the three countries, which is Britain, France, and Israel, because it's the duty of Israel to protect that water passage, they conquered Egypt that time, the aggression against Egypt, but they have been stopped by the main power, which is the Soviet Union that time, and the Americans, even though they stopped them.
Right.
And this is how Nasser succeeded to take over the Suez Canal. All right? So this is what happened. Now, living under the Jordanian regime, for us as Palestinians, in the beginning, it was okay. Till we had the new regime in Egypt, which is more revolutionary regime. So we were trying to be connected to it. And so during the time of the Jordanian era, King Hussein, we had a lot of those demonstrations in the West Bank against the Jordanian regime. We want to be free that time. We want to have our own determination. And this is the time when we had started to have our main leadership, which is the PLO, in 1964, the Palestinian Liberation Organization. And we reached 1967 when Israel had the war in June 5th, 1967, where Israel succeeded to take over Sinai, the West Bank, and the Golan Heights.
And when we are talking about the 6 days war, just a second, because I've been I heard people who say that the Arabs started the 6 day war, and to remind everybody, this was an attack of Israel on the Arab states. They say it was kind
of a preemptive attack. I will tell you what
happened. Okay, but I wanted to remind everybody that, because that's very new information, that the Israelis attacked after they had their first nuclear bombs ready. So that is an immediate connection between that, because that's in none of the documentaries I've seen on the 6 day war.
Well, back to you, Mr. Barakat. In fact, when we are talking about the main power that time, England and Britain and France, as a way to protect their new colony in the Middle East, which is Israel, they have built the nuclear power to empower Israel against the neighbors.
Yes, now, to explain that, because the technical stuff for the nuclear bomb, the Israelis got from the French. They had a copy of the atomic plant in Makul, and they were supported. So this is why you say that's but all part of the colonial history. You go ahead.
Yeah, let me add something else, which is important. All right. If you remember, I spoke about the Zionist, we call it a plan. They accepted the partition plan, and they know that the desert is dry, but they have their plan for the desert to bloom it. So in 1960, they started the main project after the nuclear power. The second main project was the water carrier, the Israel National Water Carrier, to take the water from the Jordan River to the desert, to bloom the desert. And you have to understand that the Jordan River formed from three main springs, which is Dan, Banias, and Hasbani, which their water resources, they comes from the footsteps of the Golan Heights, which was part of the Syrian properties before the war of 67. So the Syrians, because they saw that most of the water had been steered and shifted towards the Negev, so the Jordan River started to be a small stream. And this is what you could see it nowadays. But I remember in the 60s, it used to be over 15 to 20 meters wide and the clear water that time. So now it's completely different. So the Syrians were trying to build dams to stop the flowing of the water of those three main springs, because it comes to be in their land. Israel said that if you do that, I will have a war against you. I will strike you. I will never give you the chance to do it. And so Egypt have stood beside Syria and close the Tehran passage in the Sea of the Gulf of Aqaba. And this is where escalating, you know, the that thing which led to the war. And Israel started the war on the early morning on the 5th of June by having the first strike against the Egyptian airports for the Egyptian flights, and they destroyed it all. I will tell you the truth, because I was an eyewitness over the Jerusalem area. We didn't see Jordanian army in our area. We didn't see tanks in East Jerusalem, neither artilleries or kinds of heavy equipments as for the army. And when they are talking about 6 days war, I say, no way. It was less than 20 hours war in our city in Jerusalem. It had been handed completely. Because it started on the 10th of June, it was Monday, and I have seen the Israeli tanks coming on East Jerusalem on the Tuesday morning before 6 o'clock morning time. So they were in the city less than 20 hours. Now imagine, after the war of 1967, the border of Israel was enlarged so big. The population of Israel at that time was less than 2 million, maybe 1.5 million. But they need to secure a long borders, which is Sinai, the Suez Canal, the border with Jordan, which is the longest, the Golan Heights, and South Lebanon. So they need a lot of army. We didn't have that technology at that time. Only, you know, the towers, the military bunkers, and so on. But they need workers in the country. So they used the Palestinians. Now, after the war of 67, to deal with the new people under the occupation, and they had this knowledge about the Palestinians who have been living in Israel, and they gave them the Israeli citizenship. They don't want to enlarge the numbers of those people, to give all those people under its occupation the Israeli citizenship. We will be the majority. So they gave different categories for those people. Mainly the people of Jerusalem, the east of Jerusalem, they gave us a kind of status, which is an Israeli ID card, similar to the Israelis. It's the blue card, considered us as the permanent residents of Jerusalem. We are not citizens, we are permanent residents, long-term visitors of the city. This is our status, okay? And they enlarged the size of East Jerusalem. Now, to deal with the people of the West Bank and Gaza, they gave them different color ID cards since the beginning of the occupation. They gave them an orange color, and they were considered residents of the West Bank and Gaza. Okay? And even the license plates of their vehicles had been given different color since the beginning of the occupation.
Okay, I have to interrupt you again here. We have to have another round of advertisements, and I see that we will stay in the history on this hour. I might have to get you back for a second interview next week or the week after that. But because it's all interesting to understand. But first, the advertisements, then go back to your identity cards of the Palestinians and the occupied territories.
The World Health Organization's pandemic treaty is still a looming threat to our future.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
German Federal Minister of Health Dr. Karl Lauterbach had this to say about the World Health Organization's proposed pandemic treaty.
If we do not have a pandemic agreement, I fear that we lose the momentum of the pandemic. And it's an open question if we will ever have a pandemic agreement.
Let's hope the German Federal Minister of Health's warning rings true, that we lose momentum. A reminder, a pandemic treaty is nothing short of Bill Gates-funded scientists at the WHO declaring global instant lockdowns, stay-at-home orders, church closures, and vaccine and mask mandates. The World Health Organization would supersede all local authority, and lockdowns would become global. This is our future, only if we allow it. Reject the Great Reset. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute on TNT Radio.
Hi, I'm Abel.
I often forget to mention that he's an amputee because Abel will try any activity he can.
My aunt helps me with basically everything.
He doesn't see what he can't do, he sees what he can do.
Yeah, okay. This is helping.
The War Amps has just given him the ability to do all the activities every kid can do.
When you donate to the War Amps, you help kids like me. Thank you.
Dirk Pullman. On today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
With my guest, Mohammed Barakat, and he was telling us about the different identity cards for the Palestinians.
To continue.
Orange. Yeah. Okay.
So they were giving the Palestinians of the West Bank and Gaza different colored license plates, which was blue for the private vehicles and green for the public transportation. Okay. And they were considered, as I told you, they were residents of the West Bank and Gaza, because in this way they could deport anyone who works against the Israeli state. It was easy for them to deport Palestinians of Jerusalem and the Palestinians of the West Bank and Gaza. In fact, after the war of 67, because we were in the West Bank still carrying the Jordanians' passports, they usually used to deport us to Jordan. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, being under the occupation, needing labor force, they started to give us the chance to work in Israel. We were the main labor force to the Israeli state after the war of 67. And I remember, even though during the 60s, 70s, beginning of the 70s, our families from Jordan, we used to make special permissions for them to come in summer vacation to work in Israel, to get better income, to go back to Jordan. So the life of the Palestinians have been better in a way, given getting much more, you know, income. We were having better life than other Arab countries. And we came in 1973. We have the war in 1973, where Egypt in Syria against Israel. And that's where the Egyptian government, Sadat, the president, have reached with Israel the peace solutions, the agreement. And in fact, in before 1973, we didn't have a lot of colonies in the West Bank. I remember that we have almost less than 10 colonies, 10 settlements in the West Bank completely. But after this signing of the peace agreement with Egypt, Mr. Begin started to give the right to build more settlements in the West Bank. And this is where the main part of the settlements started after 1977, 78. The big settlements, which started to be erected in the West Bank and even in Gaza. Now we have 1982, the war against the PLO in Lebanon, which caused that the PLO have to step out of Lebanon and to settle in Tunisia. Even during the time of the occupation, Palestinians under occupation, as I told you, we have better type of life than other Arab countries, but we were missing one main part of a human being needed, which is our liberty. So we had the first uprising, which happened in 1987, the end of 1987, which was a loud shout to the Israeli community that we are fed of the occupation. We want to live, you know, in peace beside you, but we are looking for our freedom. That was the main part of the first uprising. Well, the Israeli society that time have received that message, and they voted and worked with the peace camp in Israel, which was led by Mr. Rabin and Peres. And that gave them the power to win the elections, which happened in 1992. The Labour Party in Israel have over 44 members in the Israeli parliament and 11 members of Meretz. And with the Arabs parties, they could have the majority in the Israeli Knesset. And that gave them the power to go on with the peace negotiations with the PLO. which happened in 1993. We call it Oslo Accords Agreement, which the Palestinians have received it in a very, hopeful that we will reach a kind of peaceful agreements, that we will have our, self-determination and have our own state, which had been signed in 1994 in the White House with Mr. Clinton, between Chairman Arafat and Mr. Rabin and Peres. And according to that agreement, the occupied territories had been divided for three areas. We call them Area A, B, and C. Now, in Area A, which is the main cities of the West Bank and Gaza, the large population areas had been given to the PLO, which had been formed what we call the PNA, the Palestinian National Authority, to have a full civil administrative and a full security control according to the Oslo Accords Agreement. And that area comes to be less than 18% of the whole occupied territories of 67. Area B, which is the surrounding villages and towns and communities, which is around the main cities, also a high populated area, had been given to the Palestinian Authority to run full civil administrative, but security in Area B had been agreed to have joint forces, an Israeli military jeep and a Palestinian military jeep to take over the security measures in Area B. And Area B comes to be less than 22% of the whole occupied territories. Now, whatever the Palestinian Authority have influenced, it comes to be less than 40%. The rest of the area comes to be Area C. And that came to be under a full Israeli military control. And Area C, we have the connecting roads between the cities. So you are living in Ramallah, let's say, and you want to move towards Nablus, which is the north city of Ramallah. You have to pass through Area C. And that's where the Israeli army have the power, the security power. So they used to stop to check and sometimes detain people, and you could not feel that you are free in your movement. In Area C, we have the main water resources for the people in the West Bank, which came to be under the military control. And that's where we have no power to drill and to pump our from our water resources to our water company. You have to buy the water from Israel inside. In Area C, we have the plains for the future planning, for the future industrial zones, for the agriculture sector and so on. We cannot use it. You have to get a permit in Area C to do any kinds of projects. Even internationals to help the Palestinians in Area C to build them a project or do something, they have to get the approval from the Israeli government. In Area C, that's where the settlements are. Imagine in 1994, when we started the peace process, should run for 5 years. According to that agreement, that part of Area C will move to B and part of B will move to A. Within the 5 years, almost 70% of the land should be Area A. What will remain for the future negotiations between the two countries is the status of Jerusalem, how Jerusalem could be controlled. Who's going to run Jerusalem? So we will leave it for the final negotiations. The border with Jordan, who's going to run the security on the border of Jordan? So we will leave it for the final negotiations. The water resources in the occupied territories, how could we do that types of agreement and arrangements between the two countries? And the last thing that will be leaving it for the final negotiations, it is the status of the Palestinian refugees. So those are the four things, the main things that we have been pushed to be talking about it and negotiating with it after we had over 70% to have a Palestinian state, and we will leave those hard things to for the future and the final negotiations. Now, Mr. Rabin was insisting to keep two big settlements blocks, to swap them inside Israel, which is Ariel in the north, and Gosh Etzion in south of Jerusalem, and to give more land to a larger size.
Mr. Barakat, I have to interrupt you here. We have about 45 seconds to go. But it's very interesting, at least for me, to get a background on this. We will continue this on a second interview somewhere later. During this time, and it shows you that it's the perspective that I got up to now is one of an occupied country which is striving for liberty and the surrounding forces for a long time. So it's in a way very much comparable to the South African situation. You even mentioned that the people had a good life. That's always an argument that we hear about South Africa, that people fled to South Africa, in fact. But this is so I interrupt you here, but we will carry on.